Welcome to this week's podcast from Innovation Forum with me, Ian Welsh. Each week we feature a digest of some news and comment on what's going on in the world of sustainable business, an update on what we're up to at Innovation Forum, and also the best of our regular interviews with business experts. Coming up shortly is a conversation I had this week with Cotton Connect CEO Alison Ward at Innovation Forum's Apparel Conference in Amsterdam about, among other things, how collaboration is positively impacting supply chains. And last week, Innovation Forum founder Toby Webb caught up with Pirelli's Eleonora Piscina in Washington, D.C. at our business and deforestation event and talked about the company's new sustainable rubber policy. Before that, though, a roundup of some of what's happening in the world of sustainable business. This week marks 5 years since the Rana Plaza factory building collapsed in Bangladesh, killing 1,134 garment workers and injuring more than 2,000 others. The disaster inspired the cross-industry Accord on Fire and Building Safety, signatories to which included many of the leading brands and companies, particularly European, that are sourcing from Bangladesh. The original Accord's terms run out this year, and a new 2018 version has been drawn up, extending its work to 2021. But this week, the international trade union body Industrial named and shamed those brands who have signed the original Accord, but not yet the new one. The Alliance on Bangladesh Worker Safety, a second effort mostly led by North American brands, has already announced that it is preparing to wrap up and hand over operations to what it described as an independent, credible, locally led organisation, developed in partnership with the Bangladesh government and the Bangladesh Garment Manufacturers and Exporters Association. While it's not clear why the two initiatives have come to different conclusions about the way forward, no doubt the brands not signing up will come under close NGO scrutiny. Human rights defender Andy Hall, who featured in our podcast a few weeks ago, has been back in the news again. He is now subject to an arrest warrant due to his non-appearance at the latest hearings for one of the four legal cases filed against him by Thai pineapple products business Natural Fruit. Hall no longer lives in Thailand following his conviction on charges related to his uncovering of human rights breaches at a Natural Fruit factory in southern Thailand, initially in 2013. Predictably, the latest Thai court move has been roundly condemned. Elsewhere, the movement towards a circular economy has been boosted by a vote in the European Parliament in favour of legislation that includes targets for boosting recycling and cutting food waste by 2030. MEPs have voted in favour of the circular economy package that includes a headline target for members to recycle at least 55% of waste from households and businesses by 2025, rising to 60% by 2030 and 65% by 2035. There are tougher targets to recycle 65% of packaging materials by 2025, rising to 70% by 2030, as well as separate targets for specific packaging materials, including paper and cardboard, plastics, glass, metal and wood. Food waste across Europe will be cut by 30% by 2025 and by 50% by 2030 under the legislation. This would put the EU in line with the UN Sustainable Development Goals. The package must now go back to the Council of Ministers for formal approval before becoming EU law. Innovation Forum has been back on the road again this week in Amsterdam for our Sustainable Apparel Supply Chains Conference. We've had some great conversations with the focus very much on better collaboration, innovation, and developing circular economy models. Thank you very much for your company if you were with us. We've got a break before our next events in June, when we'll be joined in New York on the 12th and 13th by, amongst others, experts from Walmart, Barrick Gold, Intel and GE to discuss how business can tackle forced labour and modern slavery. And our management conference on measuring the return on investment of corporate sustainability is in London on the 19th and 20th of June with Cargill, Novo Nordisk, Mars, CDP, Sancroft and many more. Turning to our interviews for this podcast, coming up, Cotton Connect's Alison Ward. But first, in Washington last week, Toby Webb spoke with Eleonora Piscina, Group Sustainability Officer for Pirelli.
So we're sitting here in the Nature Conservancy in Washington, D.C., where we are in the midst of our How Business Can Tackle Deforestation conference. And you have just done a really interesting last hour on sustainable rubber and Pirelli's policy. If you'd told me 5 years ago that I'd see Pirelli sitting here with Global Witness, a very strident NGO in their investigative work, talking about sustainable rubber policy, you know, I'd have said, could I have some of what you were drinking or smoking? yet here we are today with you and Global Witness talking about your policy. it shows, I think, we've come a long way, particularly on this issue of rubber, where I think it's fair to say the industry has been behind, or has been less high profile than areas like palm oil and other commodities. So, Eleonora, why don't you just talk us through what you've been doing at Pirelli on sustainable rubber, and maybe tell us about some of the things you've been saying in the last hour at this conference.
Okay, what we're doing, we have released our policy on natural rubber, and the policy started from the dialogue with our major stakeholders at international level and at local level, of course, starting from our main partners, who are our suppliers in the natural rubber value chain. But at the same time, we are now again working with our partners and with our stakeholders in order to build our implementation manual, because our policy is very challenging, but each point of the policy applies in a different way if you are a farmer, if you are a trader, or if you are a processor. And from this point of view, it is definitely fundamental that all this chain is capable to implement that policy, and capacity building has to start from us as we wrote that policy and we are requiring them to apply it. But all together, we can really face this challenge. And together means not only Pirelli within its supply chain, but also Pirelli with its peers, so with the other tire makers, as far as in general the issue of sustainable natural rubber is concerned, so not only Pirelli supply chain, but in general sustainable natural rubber, and also together with the major automakers and with the NGOs. You mentioned Global Witness. Global Witness is indeed very precious. It has been very precious to Pirelli in order to draft a policy on an issue that was a natural rubber sustainability starting from upstream that was quite new for Pirelli, as Pirelli is not verticalized, and what we knew about the origins of our natural rubber was very, very little compared to what these big NGOs know about this context and the suggestion they can give to you. Not only Global Witness, but also other important NGOs supported us, are currently supporting us, are in dialogue with us, and will support us in the implementation of this value chain engagement.
Okay, so Lila from Global Witness, who was speaking with you, was talking about how in some parts of Southeast Asia, around the Mekong Delta, we've seen a lot of land grabbing and a lot of sort of criminal groups taking over land and planting rubber. In a few years' time, when your policy is really being implemented and traceability is there, will you be able to make sure that your natural rubber is not coming from places like that?
That's the aim.
How will that happen? Will that be technology enabled, traceability with processors? Just describe the sort of journey that's going to happen in the next
year. Yeah, definitely. You have to start from having traceability of your natural rubber, and doing traceability of natural rubber is very difficult because in general there is a big fragmentation of farmers that produce natural rubber, and then many, many rings in the chain of traders, first of all in countries like Indonesia more than in others. And then the natural rubber comes to the processor, and many times it is the processor itself that is engaging with us in order to investigate where the rubber comes from. Because now, as at the beginning, the traceability is at the beginning, and we found that many of our processors do really not know about 100% natural rubber, where this rubber comes from. They know about the majority, but there is a part of which is unknown for them. At the same time, once you have the traceability, you have to continuously monitoring that the rubber continues going that way. And from this point of view, in general, to trace your supply chain and to monitor it, for sure the market is offering, and this is an investigation, a deep investigation that Pirelli is doing, is offering important tools that allows geographical traceability and the identification of areas of deforestation. But also it would be great to understand how big data could support this kind of process, not only in the identification, but also in the monitoring of the performances of this supply chain. So definitely, yes, tools have to support this kind of work, and the market is going to be very, very advanced from this point of view.
Okay. So from what we were saying in the session, something like 11 companies represent something like 85% of tires and the natural rubber that goes into them. So there's a lot of concentration of purchasing in the tire industry. Do you see a time fairly soon when the tire industry will have a unified approach to sustainability and traceability? Because the risk is, of course, that, you know, you guys have your policy and implementation, Michelin have theirs, Continental have theirs, Goodyear have theirs. How is collaboration looking in the next few years for the industry?
In my opinion, as far as Pirelli is concerned, I have to say that in the future we can see much engagement of tire producers together, and not only together among themselves within the sector, but also together with other major players within the value chain, meaning with the automakers and with the NGOs and so on. It is true that Pirelli and Michelin and Bridgestone have their policies, but this is because all these companies have been engaged in this kind of activity and in terms of sustainable management since many years. But it is also true at the same time that they have been working together since 2 years in order to find the best way to build a platform that is open to all the major actors within the natural rubber value chain. And so it is not, again, only the tire makers that are collaborating among themselves, but that are calling to other important stakeholders that have the capability to support the real success of such a challenge as the natural rubber sustainability is.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for giving us that overview of your work on sustainable rubber. And listeners, if you're interested in more, go to Pirelli's website, have a look for their rubber policy, which I commend to you as world leading in the sector. Eleanor, thank you so much for your support and the sponsorship of our conference. And good luck with the implementation over the next few years. We'll report back with more podcasts soon.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom.
So when I was in Amsterdam this week, I met with Alison Ward from Cotton Connect, a regular on the Innovation Forum podcast, for a wide-ranging conversation on the state of play for sustainable apparel supply chains. We've been talking about the state of play with the apparel sector. So how do you characterise the state of play in the sustainable apparel sector right now?
We're seeing amazing progress and commitments by brands. I mean, many brands have 2020 commitments for, we take cotton for 100% sustainable cotton, and we're also seeing strategies for other raw materials and fibres. I think what we can see is that we've really got clear impact at farm levels. So in our programmes last year, we worked with 43,000 farmers, and on average, they had a profit increase of 30%. So we really are making impact at a farm level, and it's very compelling. We're changing lives. And then I think we've been talking today about Tier 1, and again, we can see that there's been a big investment in understanding Tier 1, consolidation, audit. Sort of between those two poles, there's a huge supply chain that we really need to understand more and get to know more, because then we get true accountability, and whether it's about risk or whether it's about opportunities. But at the moment, I think we've looked at either end, and now we need to look at the middle.
What sort of techniques or what sort of programs can really attack that middle, as you say? Because I know you've done a lot of work, as you say, with farmers, but these farmers must then have been working with the rest of the supply chain that they're part of to gain that 30% increase in livelihood that you highlighted. So how do you get them to work with the rest of the supply chain?
I mean, it really starts with the transparency, and I think there's been two T words today, transparency and traceability. So it starts with transparency. And I think that actually we are seeing that brands can take those steps backward in their supply chain. It does take effort. People are working on Excel. This is not a fancy system at the moment. It's about really leveraging the buying power of the brands, but also the relationships. It is hearts and minds. It's not just about the process, and it's not just about an audit system. It's really about true dialogue within the supply chain. And I think that's quite exciting for the future.
Sure.
Because once we start talking to the, whether it's traders, whether it's the ginners, the spinners, you really begin to engage them in a better supply chain.
Sure. Can you think a bit more of some of your work with Cotton Connect? What evidence are you seeing specifically for a mainstreaming of sustainability in the apparel sector?
Yeah. So we work with Primark, and we're really proud of our work with them. So we work with a group of women through the Self-Employed Women's Association, so a trade union in India. But also Primark have been really committed to bring in their buyers and had a supply chain meeting last year where they really talked about their ambition. And it's great that we saw over, at the moment and over Christmas, we've got pyjama sets in store. I think they're at £6, so a really good price. But they're made with sustainable cotton from our programme in Gujarat, and we tracked it at every point. So for me, that's a real step forward. We've got a value retailer, High Street. You can buy this great pair of pyjamas, but you also know that it's under the Primark Cares banner that actually it's made with sustainable cotton.
It's a great example of a kind of a vertical supply chain that's been mapped the entire way. How can that then be taken to scale? Classic pilot, never fails. How can this sort of pilot be made to scale, though?
I mean, also, we have to remember, with Primark, I mean, it's 8 million pyjamas. They sell 1 in 3 of the pyjamas in the UK. So I would call it a big pilot. But yes, you're absolutely right. And I think that's why the discussions we've been having today are really important, because we need to show and hear from other people that are also working in this area and how they've done it. And I think that's been really, really valuable today.
Because sure. We've talked a lot about collaboration, haven't we, today? There's been a lot of talk around the sort of collaborations at work and how to take them on to scale. What other examples have you seen of good collaboration? And what are the specific parts of a collaborative process that must be there for it to work?
Yeah, we heard from Kering earlier and also from Lindex, who we've had a BCI Lindex project, and we also work with Kering on organic. And I think both of those organisations have dedicated teams, but also have really taken supplier engagement to the heart of their programmes. So they've really looked at creating a better supply chain, a more inclusive supply chain, and also perhaps had some conversations they've never had before and met some of the supply chain actors they hadn't met before.
Yeah.
So it's actually quite interesting, I think, when brands actually begin to go into their supply chain and find out who's working with them and for them. And I think that all the brands I've talked about today have done that at different levels.
There's also an interesting piece, I think, around, the talk has been recently a lot of collaboration, of pre-competitive collaboration, brands collaborating with brands, and that seems to be the thing that everyone was pushing for. But there's also a time when brands need to take responsibility themselves for their own supply chains and actually push on with their own programs and get on with it on a kind of brand or a company basis. How do you characterise that kind of dilemma between collaboration together with all the potential benefits but also the kind of the barriers versus a brand pushing on, getting on with it itself?
I think we exactly need both. And I think there are times when a brand needs to take that leadership position. And collaboration might not always be with other brands. It might be with other supply chain actors. So it could be government. It could be cotton experts. It could be other people within the supply chain. And I think those kind of, I don't know, public-private partnerships are still fashionable. But, you know, those kind of approaches where we're actually looking more broadly than just perhaps the retailers and brands, and actually looking about all the other people who were impacted in that supply chain.
This is an interesting point. I mean, public-private partnerships have had a bad name recently, but I guess sometimes people do forget why it was they were thought of in the first place. So do you think we might see more of that sort of collaboration
there? Yeah, I'd hope so, because I think if we're truly going to be sustainable, we have to work with sovereign governments. And I think that we do see that quite often we come up with great ideas here in Europe, and then we have to work with the governments in India and China and elsewhere to really, if these programs are really going to be truly sustainable. So we have to work within those contexts.
Now, something else that we have that comes up regularly at this event that we've run for the past 4 years and our other events is the potential learning from other sectors. What do you think that the apparel sector can learn from other commodity supply chains?
I think, as you know, I worked in the cocoa sector before this, and I think, I mean, some of it was the inspiration of particular programs. So it was really the work we did with Fair Trade and through Cocoa Life and Care around women that I've really taken in some of our work at Cotton Connect. So we have 21,000 women now in our programs. Fantastic to see, again, these women who really inspired them for their future. So I think there's some specific programs. But also if we look at cocoa, I mean, now every major manufacturer and every major retailer really has some kind of sustainability mark or brand or commitment on their products. And I think that you can see perhaps when I started in the cocoa sector 10 years ago, if it was that long ago, there really wasn't anything or any commitments. And I think it shows how the sector can change. And I think that for cotton, we can really see that we're a little bit behind on that journey. But I really see that that's really growing in terms of brand commitments and sort of the consumer part of the communication as well.
I guess the cocoa supply chain is different in that it's so much of it is concentrated in West Africa, in Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire, so that if you're able to involve those governments and the people involved there, then you are in fact really dealing with the entire supply chain. I mean, cotton is far more disparate in terms of its sourcing.
Yeah, West Africa is 75% of the supply. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely more disparate. But then you have got mega cotton suppliers of China and India. So beginning to work there can really drive sector change.
What are the next trends then? I mean, we've talked a lot about where we are, what we'll be talking about at an apparel sector event in 4 or 5 years' time. What are the kind of trends that you think will be coming up?
We've been talking really about the immediate impact of climate change. So we see water scarcity, we see very, very high temperatures in India, we see pollution. And I think we haven't really seen yet the impact on agriculture and not just cotton. And I think that there will be this increasing tension between food, fibre and fuel, what are we using land for? They're all all important, but clearly between food and fuel, I think we're choosing them above fibre. So I think there will be that debate and how much more will we be sort of growing raw cotton or, you know, the increase in recycling. But then if we're talking about some synthetics, you know, we were just talking about also they may be drawing on a plant base. So I think that's going to be quite important for us moving forward.
You know, a solution to that is turning to a more circular approach, but even that is not an easy thing to achieve. In terms of cotton then, because obviously that's your principal area with Cotton Connect, how far off is a circular economy model that really works for the cotton sector?
Because there isn't a burning platform at the moment, I think we're still working on what that would look like. And I think there's been good pilots again and good initiatives. But I think until there's a burning platform, I don't think we'll really drive forward. Either price won't really work, or actually the innovation comes out of necessity, doesn't it, as we always talk about. So at the moment, I think there's lots of really good work, but I think for it to really scale up, I think there would be more market forces playing.
And what do you think might cause them? What things do we need to see to happen?
You could see a decline in cotton crop. So at the moment, there isn't a risk of supply, but if a risk of supply came in, I would think that would really drive a different future.
When we get to the point of significant land use conflicts.
Or price.
Yeah,
or
then potentially there's a potential move to a more circular economy for cotton itself. What about the apparel sector as a whole then? You know, the kind of next trend for the apparel sector.
I mean, everybody has been talking about reusing the circular economy, and I think it is going to really increase. I think, though, we heard earlier, what's the business case for brands and retailers if we're in the reuse economy? And I still don't know that we've sort of understood that. So I think there's some probably quite interesting futures. Though when I reflect back, it's really interesting because I remember I did a piece of work with a business in the community, and that was probably 8 years ago, led by Prince Charles. And actually quite a lot of the predictions that group did are really coming through about in other areas, so about the sharing economy, what happens to waste and how that's reused. So I think we'll see some quite dramatic shifts in some of these emerging sort of initiatives that some of the work that Fashion for Good is doing. I think we'll really mainstream, actually.
And in fact, it came out in an earlier speaker today talking about whilst you need to be looking for the innovation and the occasional big step, in fact, the vast majority of improvements are going to be the small steps to be just need to keep pushing forward, pushing forward. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think everyone's scared by big steps. So whether it's helping your supply chain to be more accountable for where and revealing where they're buying their cotton from, or whether it's about changing production practices, the big steps are always really difficult, whereas the small incremental steps can happen and be quite accepted. And it's really part of human nature, isn't it? We don't like change. So, you know, we have to make this compelling, and not just compelling from an audit perspective, but also really giving people reasons to believe in what we're doing.
And, you know, indeed, a journey of 1,000 miles does begin with a single step. Alison from Cotton Connect, thank you very much.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
We've got the next in our webinar series on 1st of May next week, when Nestle, Verité, Isera Institute and Fresh Fields Brookhouse Deringer will be debating what a brand must do when it uncovers modern slavery in its supply chains. You can sign up for free at Innovation Forum's website or via the links on this week's newsletter. Hope you can join us on Tuesday at 3 p.m. UK time, 10 a.m. Eastern in the US. That's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh. We'll be back next week.